This morning is Gaudet Sunday. Anybody know what Gaudet is? Anybody grow up in a tradition that you have any idea what that's about? So if we were Catholics this morning, and if we were in a Catholic church that did the Mass in Latin, which we're neither one of those things, the first words in the Mass this morning would be Gaudet in Domino Semper Iterum Dico Gaudet, which is rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say to you, rejoice. And so the word Gaudet is Latin for rejoice, and it's a command to rejoice. And so somewhere along the way, I think it was in the Anglican tradition, they decided that joy is represented by a pink candle. So happy pink Sunday to you, all right? And that's where that comes from. So if you ever are looking at Advent wreaths in the store and such, you'll see that there's always three purples, a pink, and then the one we light on Christmas Eve for Jesus there is white. So that's that. So this morning, we're talking about joy, and the passage that Stephanie read came from Isaiah. So if you could turn to Isaiah chapter 35. I should have had this marked in my Bible. Whoever gets it first can call out the number, and we'll be duly impressed with your ability to look up Isaiah. You'll get a star in heaven for it. 582, Joan Keach, way to go. When I was a kid in the churches I grew up in, we had Sunday night church, and sometimes we would do sword drills. Anybody else do this? Where you'd hold your Bible up like this, not with your finger in it, but you had to hold your Bible up over your head, and then they'd call out a reference, and then whoever looked it up first was the winner and got extra stars in heaven or something. I don't know. And then some people had the little cheater tabs, which was always a source of controversy in our little Baptist church, that some people had the cheater tabs, and it just was not fair. But the pastor always won. I mean, the pastor could always beat you even without taps. That's what they teach you in seminary. I don't know where I got. How did I get here? All right, Isaiah chapter 35. Let's read it again together. And then when we're done, we're going to ask the question, what does this passage have to do with joy? All right, fair enough? So I'll read and then I'll ask you that question. And if you're new with us, it's not rhetorical. I'm asking what you think of this passage. Isaiah 35. The desert and the parched land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it will burst into bloom. It will rejoice greatly and shout for joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the splendor of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God. Strengthen the feeble hands, steady the knees that give way. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong, do not fear, your God will come. He will come with vengeance, with divine retribution. He will come to save you. Then will the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer and the mute tongue shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand will become a pool, the thirsty ground bubbling springs. In the haunts where jackals once lay, grass and reeds and papyrus will grow. And a highway will be there. It will be called the way of holiness. It will be for those who walk on that way. The unclean will not journey on it. Wicked fools will not go about on it. No lion will be there, nor any ravenous beast, nor they will not be found there. But only the redeemed will walk there. And those the Lord has rescued will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. So, Isaiah, what does Isaiah have to say to us about joy? Why, when we come to the lectionary on this Sunday, do we find this passage and what's it teaching us about joy? Everything is being put right, so that's part of the source for joy, similar to the passage we did last week. What else? It's coming, all right? So joy is out there still. It's coming in Isaiah's vision. Yes? Joy's happening when the good things haven't come yet. Is that what you said? I'm sorry. Yeah, good. Yeah, and so we talked about this idea with shalom last week, is that before you can have the shalom, things have to be put back together, that there's work that needs to be done. And some of that's really hard, roll up your sleeves kind of work, that there's something has to happen to get there. Good. What else? Yeah, this celebration that's pictured is one that's one of almost relief, that, oh, there's been this heaviness, but now it's like getting to finals week, right? There's been this heaviness, and then there's relief, especially finals your senior year in the spring, right? Like, there's a relief. Yes. I saw a couple more. Joe? Yeah. So the three themes that we've done this far, hope, peace, and joy, all tread on each other a lot, don't they? So this passage, we could also read about peace. We could also read it about hope. They all kind of they're all related. And we talked last week about how hope and peace kind of connect. And this morning, we're going to connect peace to joy as well. So, yes. Yes, joy is a promise. I'm going to hold that. I'm going to come back to that. I want to say something right now, but it's on a slide later. So I'll wait. All right? Mike and then Crystal. No. What is this? Well, there's a little bit of that with the haunts where the jackals used to hang. That's a highway now. Yeah, there's a little bit of that, but not as much. Oh, we see some of this fulfilled in miracles with Jesus. Yeah, we see some of these things, and we get hints of this in the life of Jesus. So I think, to me, what's interesting about this passage, and one thing I want to note, and we will get there, I'll tie this together a little bit later, is that this verse out of verse 4, the promise here, the precipitation of joy, is that your God will come. He's going to come to save you. Now, Isaiah was written in several sections, and mostly around exile. Some of Isaiah is pre-exile, some is written during exile, some is written post-exilic period. But the idea that God is going to come and drive out the Romans is a big idea, that God is going to come and put us back together again. Remember, if you're Israel, you're a people now without a temple and without a land, and you're asking yourself the question, are we still God's people? And the promise of Isaiah is that God will come again. God will come and he will save us. He will bring us back to our identity as a people. So that's the precipitating event, which then leads to this, that this joy is for the redeemed, that the ones the Lord has rescued. And then this picture of them entering into Zion with singing and everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy overtakes them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. I love that one, sighing. I feel like as I get older, I communicate more and more through sighing. You know, it used to be when we were younger, Jennifer and I just fought. Now we just sigh. It says so much, does it not? And so that sighing flees away. Now, here's my question for you all. And I don't want to spend a lot of time with this. But when we start talking about joy, let's move towards a definition. What are we talking about when we talk joy? What is joy? Anyone? Happiness? Contentment despite circumstances? Joy is the thing where, like, I have to be happy now even though I'm not happy. Right? I mean, kind of like, I don't feel happy, but I'm joyful. Okay, spiritual happiness. Define that more. Yes, I think we all do. Beyond happiness, something else out there. Okay. Okay. So I think we all get this right here. There's this sense that it's something beyond I feel happy. It's out there somewhere. Yes, Susan. Okay. So maybe something that you're talking about, it's about finding something and seeing something, and it has something to do with that, and it's not just these obvious moments where I should be happy. Yeah. Oh, good. So happiness is maybe more of a feeling, is external, and joy... Yeah, joy, okay, that's fine. But joy then is maybe something that is, what'd you say? It's a knowing. It's a confidence. I like that. What else? Over here. Christmas is joy. Good. Third week of Advent specifically. Yes. What else? Zach was in my office this week when we were talking about this on, I think Monday, the staff was in my office and we were talking about the weekend, what we're going to talk. And you said, joy is like when I think I'm supposed to be happy, but I'm really not, so I say I'm joyful. But this happens, right? So when you step into the Christian world, and I think there's something to this, we use this as an emotional crutch sometimes. Like, I don't want to deal with some hard things, so, and I know I'm not supposed to be sad, I'm joyful. And so we say it through gritted teeth, yeah. So maybe in a lot of our context, joy comes ridden with all kinds of guilt, right? That joy is this thing I'm supposed to have when I don't feel it, when life is bad, and I'm supposed to be joyful. And so it comes for me, I think it often, when I start thinking of joy in those kinds of ways, as a knowing and that kind of thing, then it comes guilt-ridden for me with all these things I'm supposed to be feeling when really I feel like it all sucks, right? And so this morning what I want to do is I want to try to talk about what it means to cultivate joy. And I'll tell you, when you start looking for definitions, it's hard to find. I had a hard time finding really good definitions of joy. And so I'm trying out something, and I'm asking for some grace this morning. I tried to write my own definition. I'm not smart enough to be the guy who makes up definitions of things. I'm only smart enough to read books and put quotes on the screen, all right? So I'm trying something out, and I've tweaked it about 10 times in the last 4 days, all right? But I want to try out a definition of what I think joy might look like. Because I think, Julia, I think you're right on it. I think there is something about happiness being external. Happiness, when I'm with my family on the beach at spring break, it's hard to be much happier than that. It's external. How can you not be happy when you're laying on the beach with no responsibilities and a good book and kids that can take care of their own bodily functions? We did many years of the other way, and it's not fun. But we were joyful in it anyway. So happiness comes often externally. Happiness is just these things that happen to us, but joy seems to be a deeper spiritual thing that maybe has to do with knowing. And so the definition I've been trying on as I think about what it means to practice joyfulness is this. Joy comes as a result of being at peace with myself and God. I don't think joy is something I strive after, but I think it's a result of some other strivings. I think it's a result of some other things. And if you look in the passage in Isaiah, joy is something that's the result of when God comes, when he restores. I think, Ariana, you said that he's restoring. That when he's putting it back together, joy is something that comes as a result of that goodness, of that peace that we talked about last week, that shalom. The joy is a result of that. And it's a peace, I think, that comes from a deep knowing of myself and of God. Have I pulled all those strings together? Does that start to resonate? I think that's what we're talking about when we start talking about joy. Now, I want to unpack this in a lot of ways, but I want to start here. I love this. This may be one of my top five quotes from Thomas Merton. Top five quotes ever, favorite from Thomas Merton. He says, "There's only one problem on which all of my existence, my peace, and my happiness depend, to discover myself in discovering God. If I find him, I will find myself. And if I find my true self, I will find him." Thomas Merton, some have called him the greatest American monk. He was really active in the 60s and 70s. A lot of his writings come out of that time. He's passed away since. But I find that beautiful. I'll read it again. "There's only one problem on which all my existence, all my peace, and all my happiness depend." I mean, he's laying it all on this idea. To discover myself in discovering God. If I find him, I will find myself, and if I find my true self, I will find him. How does that resonate with you? What do you hear in that? What's Merton trying to say to us? Yeah, total contentment. So when we start talking, this is describing exactly what we're talking about when we talk about joy. This knowing, this contentment, that's something that's beyond the happiness and sadness of life. Because let's just face it, not every day is happy. They kind of come and go. But this is something much deeper and profound. What else? Be who you are. That sounds like something Mufasa would say. Remember who you are. I love that part of that movie. Yeah. Okay, so ourselves are really close to us, so maybe God is really close as well. Joe's saying that the idea here is that maybe there's something about, if you examine something long enough, you can see the evidence of the one who created it. That maybe when we find ourselves, we find the evidence of the creator, of the one who created us. That's really cool. I like that. Anything else? Yeah, so this idea of completeness and wholeness and shalom that comes, and that joy is the byproduct of all those places, of when I am fully me before God, when I bring everything of myself to God, that there's this wholeness and this completeness. One of my favorite books from this past year is this book, The Gift of Being Yourself, by David Benner, and he says this, "Christian spirituality has a great deal to do with the self, not just with God. The goal of the spiritual journey is the transformation of the self. This requires knowing both ourself and God. Both are necessary if we are to discover our true identity as those who are in Christ." I think what Merton says, and then Benner has Merton's quotation in the beginning of his book. This whole book, he's kind of dedicated to that idea by Merton. And I think what he's after is this idea that sometimes in some of our religious contexts, we distrust this knowing of the self. Especially if you, I was listening to somebody the other day who was talking about coming through the 60s and 70s and all the TM and this stuff, and I got to know myself and all that. And we've grown distrustful in it, and we've put church and religion as something where we're just about knowing God. And yet what some of these writers are trying to recover is this sense that I can't really know God until I know myself. And I can't really know myself until I know God. And I can't know God until I know myself. And I can't know myself until I really know God. Did you follow all that? It was hard to keep straight. But this idea that the two go hand in hand. That as I fully understand who I am, who God has created me uniquely to be, then I come to understand God in new ways. And as I understand God, it shines the light on who I am in more profound ways. And that those two things, when I connect those two, who I am with who God is, that's where wholeness lives. That's where contentment resides. That's the knowing that leads to joy. So let's flesh this out for just a second. I want to put it in a couple categories, and I was going to fly these in individually, but they're all there for you. The first aspect is knowing myself. I've been with myself now 39 years, and there's a sense in which I know myself, right? I know what I look like generally. Don't need to see evidence anymore. But the idea of knowing ourselves as a spiritual pursuit is something different than that. We can know ourselves for a long time. Most of us are pretty familiar with our ways. And yet there's a sense in which we can often be blind to ourselves for a very long period of time. If you've ever been an employee and you've had to go through an evaluation process, you find that you are blind to some things, right? That there was things that, oh, I didn't realize I was doing that, and now my boss, my coworker is upset. If you've ever been married, you recognize all the ways that you're blind to yourself. Jennifer and I tell the story all the time about how I think that I push drawers in our house. She reports that I do not. It's a sense of source of contention. It's not a source of contention. She just has initiated herself as the official drawer pusher-inner of our relationship. But I mean well, and I really do think that in the morning when I leave, I pushed all my drawers in, and she reports that I do not. I'm unaware of myself in that instance. And that one's silly. There's a lot of ways that we're really, really unaware of ourselves. I think that joy starts in this place of being honest about ourselves and being open to understanding ourselves and knowing ourselves. And there's ways in the Christian tradition that we've gone about doing that. One of the practices that I don't do regularly and I'm trying to do more is a practice that was introduced to me called the examine. And the examine is this idea that at the end of each day, you spend time in your prayers before you go to sleep just reflecting on your day. Thinking about the events of your day and asking yourself a singular question, where did I miss God today? Where was God in my life today? And because I was busy and because I was caught up in my own headspace, I missed what God was doing in my life. And the idea of the examine is that when we do that, we open ourselves up to recognize as the place where I missed myself today, where God called me into an opportunity. I was having that conversation and that person said that thing. And in that was an invitation for me to give them a hug or to say a kind word or to mention something to them. And I missed it. And the idea of examine is not so that I can feel guilty and beat myself up, but so that I can become more aware of myself and the ways that I miss God so that the next time that thing comes around, I'm ready for it now, right? That's the idea of examine. But I think when we talk about knowing ourselves, it goes beyond even those individual pursuits. And I would say that in my life, I don't know how I even begin to understand myself outside of the community of faith. Now, you can go to church your whole life, and you can sit in the pews every Sunday, and you can miss a deep knowing of yourself, because a deep knowing of yourself requires intentionality. I was thinking about the self. Like, I know myself. I see myself in the mirror every day. I kind of get an idea. And then you get into marriage, and you get the perspective of your spouse. They tell you who you really are, right? This is what their job is, to remind you of who you really are and all the ways that you're selfish. And they remind you of your good stuff too. And they give you a picture of who you are. And yet for those of you that have been in organizations, I don't know how many of you have ever done this thing where some organizations, your evaluation is, anybody familiar with the 360 degree evaluation where somebody that reports to you and somebody you report to and peers all evaluate you? Because the idea is that we're multidimensional, all of us. And we need that perspective from a lot of different people to help understand who we are because we're much more complicated than one dimension. And so the idea of knowing myself in a spiritual context means I open myself up to places in my life. There are people in my life who know that they have a green light to speak truth to me. And I've used that language with people. You're green light people in my life. You have open permission to not just speak the bad stuff and not just tell me all the ways I'm a jerk, but also to say the good things. Sometimes some of us in here, when I start talking about knowing ourselves, we get a little nervous, right? Like, oh no, this is going to be like really painful. But sometimes it's really good. I need the people in my life to call out the goodness in me and to tell me, when you do this thing, you are at your very best. I need both. You all come in here on a Sunday morning. Some of you see me once a week. You see me right here every week. And you see me doing the thing I love, the thing that I'm best at. And most of the time, apparently, I preach a good message. and then there's a lot of other times. And I'm not saying I'm great at this, but of all the things I do, it's the thing I'm good at. So it is what it is. You don't see how neurotic I am much of the time. You don't see how I often leave here in total despair. You don't see, I was listening to an interview, Alec Baldwin interviewing Lorne Michaels from Saturday Night Live. And Lorne Michaels was saying that when the show ends on Saturday nights, he said it's usually until about Tuesday before he can stop thinking about all the mistakes that were made on the show. And he said, maybe nobody else would notice, but I noticed the actor who walked in on the right foot instead of the left, the cue that was missed, the person who missed their spot, flubbed a line. I see every bit of it. And it takes me about 2 days to empty all that stuff out of my head. And you all don't see that of me. You see me up here feigning confidence and acting like I have all my stuff together. And yet I need the community of people around me that say, okay, I know you and I know how you feel. And I need to help you know yourself. And I know you, and I'm going to support that. And we all need that community that understands us in all the dimensions. And not just the one that we have at work, and not just the one that we have at home, and not just the one that we put on in public, but in all the ways that we are ourselves in a whole variety of situations. And knowing ourselves takes a whole community. But that's one part of our definition to joy. The other part, then, is knowing God. I think I failed to mention this last week in this service. I think the second service folks got this. But in the passage we did last week in Isaiah, there was a part in the text where it talked about knowing God. And the point I made to the second service that I'm pretty sure I forgot to say to you all, this is why I loathe myself on Sundays, is I forget things. But the idea that in the Hebrew scriptures, the idea of knowing isn't split into categories. We have categories for knowing, right? There's the knowing in our heads that we know facts, but then there's the knowing of experience. So, for example, you can know facts about a certain kind of food, but you don't really know that food until you've put that food in your mouth, and then you know it experientially, right? Right? Everybody got that? And we think that way, this very Greek categories of two different worlds. And this idea of knowing God in the Hebrew scriptures, they didn't have those categories. It was all one and the same. So they even use the phrase knowing as a terminology for marital relationships, that it's about knowing facts about somebody, but it's also about the experience of someone. And the idea then is that knowing God is not just an accumulation of facts about God, but it's also an experience of God, that we know God, yes, when we learn things. And I'm not putting down learning. This week I started a book that I'm reading, and I get really excited about reading semi-academic books, all right? It gets me really ramped up, and I've been in several conversations with people this week that I can't stop talking about this book that I'm reading because I'm so excited about this book. I love it, all right? Because it's all these great ideas about God, ways of thinking about God I haven't thought about before. And I know there's going to be some of you that are going to want to know that book. I'll tell you afterwards. But there's an intellectual component to that. But there's also a component of knowing God that only happens by experiencing God. And I don't just mean in charismatic kind of ways. And those ways are good. There is space for contemplation and meditation and silence and having epiphanies and having these moments of clarity. I've had these moments in my life where I've just known experientially. There's been two times I can think of specifically where I have just known in just a couple moments, I have been totally confident of how deep God's love was for me. That's not a normal experience for me. I go about 3 days before I get neurotic about this person hasn't talked to me. Do they still love me? Right? Like, I'm neurotic about that sometimes. And yet there's been twice in my life where I just knew in a very specific moment the depth of God's love for me in a very experiential way that I can't totally explain. And I'll tell you, in both times, puddle of tears when it happened. That's an experience. I can teach you a theology of God's love all day long. I'm going to try to do that next week because we're talking about love. But there is something else to experiencing that. And there's a lot of ways we experience God. Sometimes we put him in just those kinds of epiphany kind of moments. But I think we also experience God when we do what we talked about last week, when we participate in shalom. When we do the work of God in this world, we experience God. When we get up and drive here when it's like 9 degrees out and we feed the poor, that is experiencing the work of God. When we give our money and our time and our efforts, when we participate in what God is doing in the world, when we forgive somebody because it's what Jesus has called us to do, in all the ways that we obey God, we know God. We come to experience God when we obey. Which brings us to the language of blessing and cursing. I was having a discussion with Dustin and Jesse. We're reading a book together. And we were talking about this language where God says to Abram, I will bless those that bless you, and I will curse those that curse you. And the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the peacemakers, blessed are those who mourn. And the subtle implication on the other side of that, well, is if you're not blessed for mourning, then you must be cursed. And this language of blessing and cursing is throughout the Bible. But the writer we were reading, and I thought this was really beautiful, because it sounds like when we start talking about blessing and cursing, that God's love is unconditional unless you reject him, and then he will curse you for it. And then it doesn't sound very unconditional, does it? It feels sometimes in this language that we get this idea that I will like my kids as long as they like me back, but the second they do something that I don't like, I will rain down wrath on their pretty little heads forever and ever, right? And he was saying that what this language is about, and I think this is what we get to joy, is he says, think of the love of God or the way of God in the world as the jet stream. God is trying to do something in our world. It's related to shalom. It's related to putting everything back together. That's the airstream of God. That's the wind of God moving through the air. And when we choose to obey, when we choose to go on a journey of knowing ourselves and knowing God and experiencing God, then it's like stepping into the jet stream, and we now have the wind of God at our back. That's the blessing of God. And the cursing of God is just the opposite, that when I choose against God, when I choose to do things with my time and my money and my energy that are against God, it's like trying to fly into it. The wind of God now is at my face. It's not that God goes around picking and says, I want to curse this person and I want to bless this person. It's that God is doing this, and we choose whether to step into the wind or the current of God or to swim against the current. I think that's really beautiful, isn't it? And I think that is what joy is. I think joy is when I know myself and I know my God and I step into what God is doing in the world and I feel the wind of God at my back. And so joy is becoming more me. Joy is knowing more of God and bringing everything I know about myself to everything I know about God. At 39, I think I know myself better than I ever have, and I don't think that journey's complete. I think at 49, I hope I stand in front of you all and say, I know myself better than I ever have, and I hope that journey continues until the day I die. And at 39, I would say that I think I know God better than I ever have. I feel like I'm growing in my understanding of God, and that's being changed, and I'm always thinking about new things. And so the journey is always bringing everything I have, everything I know of myself, and bringing everything I know of myself to everything I know about God for the sake of the world. So that the God's project of shalom will be fulfilled. Let's just get down to really honest, here's how this looks. There's a temptation in our culture. This is not rocket science. There's a temptation in our culture to define ourselves by what we buy, correct? Can we all agree with that? There's a temptation out there, especially at Christmas time, to define ourselves by what we buy. Apparently, all of you guys are buying your wife Mercedes as a surprise gift for Christmas, because I think that's what happens, right? Is that what everybody else does? Because then you'll be happy if you do that. By the way, I don't know anybody who's ever done this, right? So get it out of your minds. What was I going to say? Oh, so the temptation is there to define ourselves. Just totally blank slate right in front of me. About a month ago, we finally decided that the van that we'd been driving, uh, the, that was 13 years old was done, right? And it had 239,000 miles on it. I don't know, something crazy. A lot of miles. And the engine was still working, but that, things were, when you go through the drive-thru, you had to open your door because the window didn't roll down anymore and silly things like that. Door locks didn't lock and all that stuff. And so we decided it was finally time to go get a new van. And so we got a new van. And, or newer, not new, newer van. And there was a lot of happiness in our family, right? Because things worked again. There was a lot of happiness, and the kids were about giddy, about new buttons to push. And they still are, just a little bit. And I won't lie, it's fun to get a new car. I like getting new cars. That was happy. It's over now. It's just a car. It's just a thing. And at every point, as followers of Jesus, that we choose to buy into the myth that we are what we buy, if I just buy a bigger house, I'll be happy. If I just buy these clothes or buy this thing or get this job promotion or have this, if I just have this much in my bank account, then I will be happy. We will be sadly disappointed because that's not where the wind of God is. The wind of God is flowing across this world into changing the world wherever we can, wherever we see injustice, and all the ways we talked about shalom last week. That's the wind of God in the world. And when I step into that wind, that's where God's blessing comes. That's where I find joy. There are some of us in this room who are missing out on the wind of God because we refuse to put our gifts to use in the kingdom. We're really talented at a certain thing, and I'm not thinking of any individual examples, but we're really talented at this one thing, and we know that we could serve, we could put that thing to use in this church or in this city, and yet we refuse because we want more for us. We want our time and our thing and this thing and that thing, and we refuse, and because of that, we don't know joy. We do not have God's wind at our back. There are some of us who don't give what we should. That we've believed the lie that if I just have this much, if I just go out to eat here, if I just have this car and this thing, I will be happy. And we're missing the wind of God because we won't put our giftedness to use. We won't do the things that we know to be true of the people of God. And so here's the invitation this morning, is that we are coming up on the end of the year. And I know that in the first of the year, many of us make resolutions that we think about our lives again. It's a good chance to. You know, you get a couple weeks off, and then you come back on the first, and you rethink, okay, what's my life about, and what am I doing, and what are the things? I got to get back on that diet, and I got to get back on that reading plan, and I got to do this, and whatever your thing is, I've got to stop this thing and that thing. We do that at the first of the year. And I want to challenge you on the 15th of December to start thinking about that, because what often happens is I get to January 1st, and I say, I got to think of something. I'm going to lose more weight again. And it's not any thought towards that. It's just something I throw out there. But I want to challenge you that maybe the invitation for the week of joy for God at Sunday in December is to think about what my life looks like in January. And maybe there's a place that you need to serve in this church. And maybe it's in our community. I'm not myopic about just being in our church. But maybe there's a place in your life where you have to put your gifts to use. There's a space where you need to feel God's wind at your back. And maybe for some of you, that has to do with money. And at the end of the year, you know, you hear churches talk about year-end giving, and there's something in the notes about year-end giving. And I just want to say to you, just to paint a picture for us as a church, that we're really healthy. Giving is really healthy. It's good, all right? I'm not standing here because we're desperate. We're not desperate. But it's not about that. Jennifer and I put money in the plate because we believe it's what God is leading us to do. And that the blessing that comes out of that is not more material wealth, but it's knowing that the wind of God is at my back. That's joy. And so some of you, there's options at the end of the year. Some of you get to the end of the year and you get bonuses and you look at your accounts and you do some evaluation of your finances. And maybe God is calling you even in this time of the year to give something above and beyond what you normally give. And in our church, you can see in the notes there, you can send that to the general fund, or you can put it towards the what we spent moving into this building. When we moved into this building, it cost us just under $40,000 to do everything that we did to get us in this building. And we've raised about 22 of that back. And so we're still pushing to keep raising that. And for a while ago, Kevin got up and asked you all to consider just doing 1%. But I just want to say, I admire what he said, and there's some of us that makes a whole lot of sense. But I also know that there's been times in my life where to even change 1% in our budget, we just didn't have 1% to change in our budget. There have been times in our life where we weren't eating out, and we weren't buying clothes, and we were scraping by. And when something broke down, we had to put it on a credit card because there was just no other way to pay for it. And it was really, really hard. And to do 1% was too much. And what I want you to hear from me is don't give nothing because you can't give 1%. I love the story of Jesus where the woman puts the 2 coins because it's what she could give. And whatever God is calling you to give, you should give that. Step into the current of God at whatever level. And on the other side of it, there's some of us in this room that 1% is a cop-out. There's some of us in this room that 1% doesn't mean I adjust my life at all. It's just a check. And I believe that the wind of God is calling us all to sacrifice. Not just our money, but our time and our energy and our passions. And when we do that, when we know ourselves and we know God for the sake of the world, we will feel joy. We will feel the wind of God at our backs. Let's pray together. God, help us to know joy, to be agents of shalom, to bring peacemakers wherever we go. God, help us to be that. God, help us to respond to the leading of the Spirit, God, in whatever way. Some of us are sitting here and we feel deep conviction about ministries that we know we should be serving in, and money that we know we should be giving. And maybe, God, it's not even about Imago Dei Church, that we know there's a ministry in this community that I need to be more involved in, or a cause that I need to give my money to. God, help us to be people that have our hands open, that really do believe that joy comes from having your wind at our backs. God, lead us as a church. Help us to be a church that's asking ourselves that about our resources. God, where do you want us to be involved? Where is your wind pushing us in this community, in our world, in our city? In your name I pray. Amen.